family. Adam Smiley Kosowski is an internationally renowned keynote speaker. His workplace, belonging, and future of work expertise have made him a best-selling author of three books that have been translated into multiple languages. These books include The Quarter Life Breakthrough and Friendship in the Age of Loneliness. He has TED Talks available, and his website is rich with information. We share it here with you. We're especially happy to share this conversation. Smiley approaches one of the most difficult conversations with a lot of fun. Enjoy. Adam, welcome. It's fantastic to have you here at J Ask JBH.
Thank you, Janice. It's wonderful to be here. I'm so excited to have a conversation with you.
Oh, yes, we have so many things we care about in common. And a little bit as though I already know you. I visited you on YouTube, which I encourage all of our family to do. And you're just so well written as well as well spoken. But importantly, you are well lived for someone at your age. Listen, I want you to talk a little bit about the TED Talk you did, because I think it was entitled Refusing to Settle, The Quarter Life Crisis. This topic resonates with so many people in the early stages of their careers, and our family here listening really should watch your whole TED Talk. So you don't have to recount everything about it. For the sake, though, of finding and pursuing what's meaningful to you, will you talk a little bit on that idea before we jump into our conversation?
Sure. Yeah. So that's a talk I gave quite a little while ago now. I gave it around the age of 30. So it's not quite my quarter life, you know. I wasn't going to live to 120, but it feels like quarter life. And I think a lot of people in their 20s can identify with this time in your life where maybe you've done all the things on paper that you're supposed to do, but it doesn't feel like it's turned out right. Maybe you've gone to college or tried to get into a good school and landed a job, and maybe your parents are kind of like, "Hey, good job, you know, you did it." And you're like, "I hate this job," or "This isn't the right job for me," or "This is not what I'm meant to do." And maybe you don't know exactly what it is that you're meant to do, but you know that what you're doing isn't quite right. So that's kind of the experience I had.
That happened for a lot of people during and post-COVID as well. So it's highly relevant now. What do you
Yeah,
think?
exactly. There was this whole experience, as you are well aware of, around quiet quitting and people kind of recalibrating the role of work in their lives. Of course, they have to work. We all have to work. But kind of a little bit of thinking of, you know, is this job right for me? You know, COVID and the pandemic really made us think about, you know, we spend a lot of our waking lives working, and what do we want to be spending our time doing? And many of us faced in our families and our communities a lot of grief, a lot of death, a lot of pain, and people kind of came into contact with, "Hey, I have a limited time here in this life on this earth. What is it that I want to do?" And you know, that for me was very real around the age of 30. I was working a job that, you know, on paper, a lot of other people were quite impressed by, but I had this kind of inner knowing, this inner sensation that it wasn't the right fit. And I think that that's an important thing, is that, you know, it doesn't matter if the work we have is impressive on LinkedIn or to another person. If it's good on paper, that's not actually the point. The point is to find meaningful work for ourselves. And the only person that can really help us figure that out is you know, surprise us. And it's okay if it, you know, I also want to make sure that people understand it's not like you snap the fingers and that happens, or you read a book or listen to one podcast or meditate for 10 minutes and all of a sudden you're like, "I know what my life's purpose is." But I do think that it is important for people to kind of come into contact and question those things, especially for people that have the ability, the privilege to do so, because not everyone does, right? And I think it's really important that people take the time to kind of figure out what meaning and what purpose looks like to them. So that was really kind of the basis for my quarter life crisis, of feeling very kind of almost guilty almost like, I know this should be enough, but it's not. And I know that I have so much more to give. And I know that I'm not reaching my full potential. And I'm old, quote unquote old, like I'm almost 30 at the time, which is society kind of makes you think that that's old. It's not that old, believe me. I am 40 years old now. It's still not that old. And no one is that old. But the point is, you know, I really had this experience of feeling quite stuck and feeling a lot of FOMO, right? Fear of missing out. So you're worried about what everyone else is doing. So I remember, and this is in the, you know, earlier days of social media, it's actually quite worse now, but that was in the big days of Facebook and Twitter and, you know, people posting all the time on what they were doing. And I remember being jealous of my friend who was going off to business school, jealous of a friend. She was opening up a food truck. And I was like, maybe that's what I should do. Maybe I'm put on earth to open a food truck. I'm not a very good cook and I like can't even drive. So, but still maybe it's a food truck. Comparing myself to everyone else, like you know, I see a photo of a buddy of mine. He had gotten an incredible job at this firm in New York City. He's getting married. I see a photo of him. He's proposing in front of Machu Picchu, and I'm like, man, like I can't even get a date on Tinder. You know, like my life is ruined. I'm a goner. I'm never gonna make it. And it was really, you know, one of the lessons I learned is it was actually when I spent a little bit of time off of social media that I was able to kind of flip this quarter life crisis, midlife crisis into a breakthrough and find more meaning, find more purpose in my own work. And I think that that's an important lesson. It's less about comparing yourself to others and more about figuring out how you can serve other people, right? Stop comparing yourself absolutely. To others. Start figuring out, you know, how you can benefit others. Like, what is your gift to give to other people? That was a big thing for me is really figuring them out. Starting to care for other people and figuring out what that looked like for me, because it's going to be different for everybody.
I think you're so right, Adam. And regardless of whether you are investing this time to think about how you're gifting to other people, or even if you're a little bit more selfish about how am I fulfilling myself, I think quarter life is somewhere around that mid-20s is a very good time to have it and can soften the midlife crisis, which comes with this whole set of issues, concerns, cares, and opportunities. From your own career and life journey, what personal experiences or challenges have shaped your understanding of workplace belonging and team engagement? You do a lot of talking about this, and you actually do a lot of teaching about this. Here's a platform that handily listen to what you have to say and engage that in their own processes and life systems.
Yeah, I think that, you know, what I found is that this is just a really timely topic right now. So, and one of the reasons why that is that you have to think about the fact that even before the pandemic, you know, where we've seen this big shift to hybrid work and remote work and less people going in and into the office every day, we were in the midst of a loneliness epidemic here in the United States and around the world, actually, prior to 2020. So the Surgeon General of the United States has actually called this the loneliness epidemic, an epidemic, right? One in two Americans, fully half of Americans are lonely. And it's not like people are lonely when they're home or at the coffee shop or at the playground with their kids, and then they go to work and it suddenly goes away, right? Like, people are still lonely. That's how they're showing up at work, or when they sit down at their living room table or the kitchen table and they're on their Zoom calls or team calls working. So people show up very lonely at work, and it costs businesses a lot of money. More lonely employees have more sick days. You know, more missed days at work, they're less likely to receive promotions, they're less likely to be productive, they're less engaged at work. So this is actually showing up and affecting the bottom line of businesses. And on the foot, you know, lonely employees can cost U.S. companies alone $406 billion a year in lost productivity. So this is a major cost. So one of the things that I'm trying to do is help people build belonging at work, because belonging is really the antidote to loneliness. Right? When you create this sense that people can be who they are, they can be their authentic self, they have more friends at work, they have a community at work, they feel supported and seen, they have that sense of psychological safety, they can take risks, they can ask questions. That creates more of a sense of belonging. And that might not solve the loneliness epidemic, but it helps. It really helps. And it helps people, you know, just as a one statistic.
Talk a little bit about the difference between between loneliness and being alone. Certainly I'm a Southern girl, so I've heard enough songs and enough old folks talk about the difference between, look, just because I want to be alone doesn't mean I'm lonely.
Yeah.
But it is, and we can laugh at it as we're doing now, but it is a serious conversation that can help widen or lift someone's ideas and thoughts around them.
Yeah, there's a very big difference between social isolation and loneliness, right? So social isolation is just like you are not around other people and you may or may not be lonely, right? So some people, you know, let's say you're a writer and you're like, I'm going to a cabin in the woods to get away. I want to write my book, or I just need some self-care time. I'm taking time. You're not feeling lonely. You're just isolating yourself from other people. You may also be lonely if you are isolated from others, right? But you may not. So loneliness is actually that the definition, the scientific definition, is kind of that subjective gap between where your level of connection is and where you want it to be. That's actually what the research shows loneliness really is. It's that feeling of being like, okay, I feel like here, but I really want to be there in terms of the level of social connection in my life. And I feel like one of the reasons why that's so low for so many people is, you know, we're constantly perceiving that other people are so much more connected than we are, right? If I think about young people, right? So 80% of Gen Z, so that's folks that are born after 1997, right? So the oldest members of Gen Z, if any of the family and folks listening right now have teenagers, have kids that are just entering the workforce now, 20, 21, 22, those folks are part of Gen Z. 80% are lonely. And some people say young people are lonely. How could they be? They're spending 3 hours a day on TikTok. All they do is DM their friends or send an emoji or send texts to each other, right? They're not lonely. Well, it actually turns out that that's not real social human connection. You know, it's something, but sending a DM, sending an emoji, double tapping a photo or scrolling all day long is not actual social connection. It takes 90 hours with someone IRL in real life or on like a video call, like with an actual person, for them to become a friend. 90 hours, right? Like that's what it means to actually have human connection in this world. It takes time and you can't just swipe right to find it. It takes a lot of time. So I think that's one of the reasons why people have this kind of perception of loneliness is they think everyone else, because the highlight reels on Instagram, you know, on TikTok, everything looks so pretty, but really the reality is that everyone is struggling a little bit. Everyone is looking for a little bit more human connection. You know, and I think if we stop comparing ourselves to others and start figuring out how we can build more connection in our everyday lives, you know, one of the things I write about in my most recent book, Friendship in the Age of Loneliness, is how we can all be more ministers for loneliness in our own communities. Right. So there are a lot of countries have actually named a minister for loneliness. I think Britain has one, Japan has one, because they recognize how important of a role this is, right? To someone to think about it at the government level, the policy level. But what would it be like if we all kind of existed in our own neighborhoods, our own communities, our own towns, our own cities, thinking like a minister for loneliness, just on a small level of getting to know the people on your block, of getting to know the people at your coffee shop, of your local public library, at work, of connecting people or remembering someone's coffee order, right? Or their children's names or all these little details, they go such a long way of creating a little bit more connection in our world.
That's so smart and, you know, thoughtful on an individual level. What are some of the strategies or insights that you can offer organizations to implement that may simplify individuals' lives and stress in the workplace? Many of the people listening to us actually have the aegis or responsibility to offer solutions, just as you can discuss with them now.
Yeah, it's a great question. I like to say that, you know, belonging isn't just HR; it's everyone. HR's job; it's everyone's job. So I think that, you know, sometimes people think like, oh, this is just something that HR worries about, or if there is a DEI team that DEI worries about, or the culture team worries about. I actually think belonging is everyone's job. Certainly every leader from the C-suite down to every single senior level executive, mid-level manager, supervisor, but frankly, everyone's job to create that sense of belonging. And I think one way we do it is we build human connection into every aspect of the employee experience. So a lot of times when I, you know, people say, look, we don't have time for belonging. We don't have time for connection, which is kind of funny if you think about it. It's like, how can we get connection? We don't even have time to do it. We have to get our work done. And I say, okay, well, what we're trying to do is not add additional meetings onto the calendar. We're building connection into the entire employee life cycle, into the employee experience. So let's just start, for example, where that would begin, let's say in onboarding, right? In training. So like the kind of very first time you're hiring, you know, that is an incredible opportunity for connection. It's the first time someone is starting a new role. And really, I think it used to be that we thought of those onboarding and training opportunities as, okay, this is about telling people what they need to know about working here, right? All of the rules, the regulations, here's all the paperwork you have to fill out. You know, here's how to use your computer and set up your email and set up all of the different software tools that we use, right? Here's how we do things. And I don't think it's really that as much anymore. It's, can we make help people make a new friend, right? That's what the point of onboarding is. Yes, we have to get to all of the things. We have a checklist we have to go through. There's regulations and there's legal compliance things we need to do, we need to cover, and we will cover all that. But we have a limited amount of time together. It might be a couple hours. It might be a day. It might be a week to go through this stuff. Let's make it more about the connection. I had a friend, my friend Joanna Miller. She was running learning and development at Asana, which is a very task management software company based in the Bay Area, a very successful company, venture-backed. And she told me, you know, I think they onboarded over 1,000 people during the pandemic virtually, which is a very difficult thing to do, right? Mm-hmm. Especially for early career folks to start a job and you've never had an opportunity working in an office, right? Or never even seen or met your manager. Very hard to do, right? And she told me that what people most got out of onboarding was, did they make a new friend? Could they go through the experience and turn to someone and be like, you know what? I'm not sure I understand what's happening here. Me neither. Let's be friends. Right? Or I don't really agree with what this person is saying. Me neither. Let's be friends. So that's what onboarding and training was all about. So kind of building that connection, building that belonging into onboarding, into training, into weekly team meetings, into one-on-ones, you know, even if it's a 5-minute kind of exercise at the beginning where people do a personal check-in or an exercise, switching up facilitators during a meeting, kind of building that those opportunities for belonging into the everyday experience of working there, not just kind of once a year, because that's what usually happens. It's like, okay, let's do team building once a year at an offsite or a team retreat. And that's important. We need to do those, but it's more important that we kind of create opportunities for belonging throughout the year. So what I'm getting at the bigger piece here is that you have to build the culture of belonging, right? Which is actually making sure that people feel safe, making sure that they feel seen, making sure that they feel connected, you know, having access to mentors, having access to coaches within your work so that you already kind of have that sense of someone looking out for you, someone kind of that is helping you get to the next level, that's got your best interests at heart, but that creates more of a sense of belonging throughout the culture.
That's beautiful. And you talk about making a friend and it being the job of onboarding or one of the outcomes of onboarding, to feel that you are in an environment where you can make a friend. You also tell a story that you and I talked about before that I love, a guy named Bernard, who is basically a guy on a bicycle in San Francisco who approaches you. And I think it's a beautiful story about belonging because it tells us how everything is interconnected. Would you summarize that story here for our family?
I'd be happy to, JBH. Yeah, it's a fun story. I love this story because I think it kind of shows us the power of making the ask and putting ourselves out there. So, you know, I had lived on the East Coast for many years, most of my life. I moved out to San Francisco, you know, when I was in the midst of that quarter life crisis, is, you know, city of many dreamers and many creators and artists. And I set out on my dream of becoming an author, right? You know, it turns out writing a book is quite hard to do. For those of you listening that have done it, you'll identify with that. It's not easy. And also San Francisco is one of the most expensive cities in the world. So I was like, maybe I had made a bad decision by like quitting my job and starting a whole new life. And maybe this isn't going to work out. So one night I'm biking home, minding my own business, on a bicycle, biking. I was on my way to get some dinner, to get some tacos. And all of a sudden this guy bikes alongside me and says, "My name is Bernat. I'm from Spain." And I had no idea who this guy was. So I tried to bike away, right? And he keeps biking alongside me and says, "My name's Bernat, I'm from Spain. I'm a designer." And I was like, "Please leave me alone." You know, I kind of bike away, and he keeps following me. And he says he's from Spain. He's a designer. He's from Barcelona. He's looking for a design job because there's so much unemployment in Spain where he was from. He couldn't find a job. That's why he was in San Francisco looking for a job. And, you know, we're talking. I said, "Oh," and we're on a bicycle this whole time, by the way. and I said, "Barcelona, it's a beautiful city. I visited once because I knew someone that lived there." And he's like, "Yeah, Barcelona's great." He asked me what I was up to. And I told him I was writing a book about people trying to find more meaning and purpose in their lives. And he asked me if I had a cover designer yet. And I said, "No." And he's like, "Well, go home, check out my website. Maybe we can work together." So I go home after getting some tacos, obviously. And I go home, I check out this guy's website, this guy Bernat's website. I was like, he's pretty good. He had like his portfolio, sample of his work. He was a pretty good designer. So that night I posted on Facebook, "Just met this wild guy Bernat while I was biking home tonight. He hails from Spain. He's looking for a design job. If you know of anything, let him know." A couple weeks later, right then, there's a comment on the thread that says, "Oh, Bernat should meet with my friends. They're doing a mobile startup in Palo Alto, California. There's five of them. They don't really have a lead designer yet. Maybe they can work together." A couple weeks later, Bernat meets with the team. He gets hired to be the lead designer for this tiny little startup in Palo Alto. He gets a work visa to stay in the United States, which was a very big deal for him because there's so much unemployment in Spain where he's from. This is, you know, very important for him. He sends me like a thank you note, like, "Hey, thank you so much, Smiley." But really, like a couple of years go by, I don't really hear from the guy. And a couple of years after that, I get a text message from him out of the blue, completely out of the blue. "Smiley, I'm taking you out to dinner anywhere you want to go." And I was like, "That's amazing. Sure. Free food. Like, great. You know, let's go out. We go to this nice meal. We get a bottle of wine." And I'm like, "What's going on? Why are you taking me out to dinner?" Well, it turns out that the mobile startup he had been working for had just been acquired by Yahoo for $80 million. And he's the fifth employee at the company. He's paid almost entirely in equity. Like, he definitely could afford to take me out to dinner. And he says to me, like, "Smiley, thank you. Thank you. This wouldn't have happened if not for you." You know, and I said to this guy, I said, "No, man, thank you." Because he talked to a random stranger in a city he didn't live in a country he wasn't from, on a bicycle. Right. Like, who the hell does that? So, you know, what I'm getting at is, like, we got to create the culture, you know, at our organizations and companies for sure, but even just in our, you know, our schools, our communities, wherever we are, where people can make those big, bold asks. They can channel that inner Bernat. They can go outside their comfort zone. They can speak their truth. They can say what's on their mind. And no, we're not going to be able to get a job to everyone that asks us. Or if we, some strange times, a stranger's going to talk to you and you're like, "Not today," or like, "I'm sorry, I can't help you right now." But you allow people to feel safe enough to say what they need. And even if we can only say yes, you know, some of the time, we create that culture where people can make those big, bold kind of asks. And that is creating belonging, right? That's creating that sense of safety, that sense where people feel like they can actually be themselves.
It's such a beautiful story of belonging, even beyond the ability to invest in that and gain career movement or social movement. I mean, it's the story of America, isn't it, with our arms open wide. And so I just love that. And I'm so grateful to you for sharing it, Smiley. You did a TED Talk that sheds light on the alarming rates of burnout and mental health, which are oftentimes contributors to why people are reluctant, hesitant, or afraid to actually explore belonging. And in your TED Talk, you talk about mental health challenges amongst millennials. You've also spoken on the topic of friendship in an age of loneliness. Do you think this loneliness era is at its peak still, Adam, or where do you see this progressing to in the future of remote work and isolation?
Yeah, unfortunately, I wish I could say that I think it's going to get worse before it gets better. And I've dedicated my kind of my working life to helping, you know, I believe this is one of the major challenges of our generation. And the reason I think it's going to get worse is basically as we go deeper and deeper into technology being part of how we work, how we live, especially now with the impact of AI, and we're seeing this, you know, with ChatGPT, artificial intelligence, all these things. You know, we also need to design for human connection even more so. So I actually think that, you know, we are going to, as a society, we're still kind of realizing how bad it has to get before we fix it. So I don't think that this problem is going away anytime soon. I'd like to say it's going to change tomorrow, but I think it's going to take a lot more work and a lot more attention before it does. So friendship is at its lowest rate in 30 years. Which is quite alarming. 1 in 5 people don't have someone for a close social connection. 15% of men have 0 close friends at all, which leads to so many toxic outcomes when we think about men and all of those correlated kind of downstream impacts of not having close friends. There's all this data around loneliness being really dangerous to your health. The Surgeon General said it's as dangerous as smoking 15 cigarettes a day. Right. That's how unhealthy it is to be lonely. And, you know, we've built a society that is not necessarily designed for people to make friends easily. With remote work, on the one hand, what's what I call kind of the paradox of remote work, it's that people want it. Right. We're not going. If you're a CEO right now listening to this and you're trying to get your employees in 5 days a week at their office in Dallas, in Houston, in New York, in LA, like, you know, that is hard, if not impossible. If you tried it, you've probably had a lot of people get very upset, maybe even quit. We're not kind of going back to the way things used to be. So people, if you ask them, 99% of them prefer to have at least somewhat of a hybrid schedule. They'll come in a couple of days a week, but they want to work from home Mondays and Fridays or a couple once or twice a week, right? But at the same time, even though they want more remote work, right? More flexibility, more time with their kids, more ability to have autonomy over their schedule, not have to commute. Nobody likes to commute, spending, you know, 45 minutes a day in traffic or getting on the metro, the subway, the bus. But they're also reporting the highest levels of disconnection and loneliness and burnout ever before. So those are two very interesting facts. They want to work from home more. They want more remote work. They want to call in from their kitchen table, from their home office, from their desk, from their daughter's bedroom, wherever they can get that kind of space at the house. And yet they're more disconnected than ever before, because we're not spending as much time with our colleagues, right? And as a society, people don't spend as much time with other people, anymore. So this is something that I think we have to create those opportunities for human connection when people are together at the office and in a hybrid or remote environment. So it is a really, really important thing now. If people are not going to come in every day and see their colleagues, we have to create that opportunity, you know, for those quarterly retreats, those, team meetings, where people can kind of come together and have that in-person connection.
So then, was loneliness a thing before COVID, or are we just hearing it talked out loud? Sort of like breast cancer existed before Betty Ford talked about it, but we all gained a different approach to consciousness of it and an action toward it. once she spoke about it. Is that a correlation to how we're treating loneliness? Or was loneliness really not that big thing before people sat back and did the reflection during COVID?
Yeah, I mean, there's data that loneliness was spiking even before the pandemic, right? So even before kind of this whole experience, this was a thing. It just wasn't talked about as much. Like, I'll use the example of pitching my book to publishers. So, you know, I pitched that book, Friendship in the Age of Loneliness, at the end of 2019. So I didn't know there was we didn't have, if you can go back, it's hard for us to picture it, but go back and forget you even knew about masks or lockdowns or any of this stuff, right? COVID, it wasn't even a thing then. And I remember the publisher being like, we really love this idea, friendship, it's important, but you can't have loneliness in the title. And I said, well, why not? Well, they said, well, nobody wants to admit that they're lonely. No one's going to buy a book with loneliness in the title because it's like a pathology. It makes you feel bad. It's like you don't want to admit it. I said, well, I'm lonely. That's why I wrote the book. I'm writing about other people that are lonely. I'm writing because I think this is really important today. They're like, well, we'll buy the book, but you might have to change the title. And I said, okay, fine. You know, so I agree to that. And then 2 months later, 3 months later, it was March 2020. And they're like, okay, it's the pandemic. We can put loneliness in the title. So the point being, it took a pandemic for us to start talking about loneliness, right? Mm-hmm. That should be alarming, right? It took a damn pandemic for us to start talking about loneliness. And I think similarly, it took the pandemic for us to start talking about mental health in the workplace, right? It took a pandemic for us to start talking about the needs of working parents in the workplace and working women in the workplace who had been talking about all this stuff for years, for decades, like, how am I supposed to get all my work done, take care of my kids, go to the doctor's appointments, fill prescriptions, see a therapist, buy groceries, when I'm literally at an office between the only hours that those places are open? I got to take a day off of work. Am I getting paid for the day off of work? No. Okay. So let's talk about, you know, like, this is clearly unfair for people that have young children or for people that are a single parent, right? This is all true 5, 10, 15 years ago, 30 years ago, we just didn't talk about it, right? Or it was brushed under the table. So the silver lining, at least, of the pandemic is that it brought out a lot of conversations that, frankly, we should have been having much sooner. Right? It brought to the forefront these issues around flexibility, around equity, around inclusion, around remote work, around mental health, around burnout, around loneliness. So hope we're having those conversations now, but it's a journey and a process in terms of implementing all of these changes.
Yeah. So let's go on a tangent in order to put some connection to possibility around what you're talking about. The tangent is, you're familiar with the inner child, the idea of the inner child, yes?
Yes.
If us has an inner child. When, and COVID, the pandemic, was a perfect place when a lot of people started to experience feelings and thoughts about decisions they've made about life and left it right there. But those feelings and thoughts and ambitions that they held were framed from the place that the inner child was born within them. In the spirit of reflection, Adam, take us back to our inner child time and speak to us with advice that you think we should be giving our inner child about our career journey, regardless of where we are on it or the path we've chosen to take?
Oh, I love that question. That's such a beautiful question. You know, I think play is a really important part of work. I think it's something that, you know, kind of gets drawn out of us, right? In terms of, when we go to school and, you know, college and kind of the so-called career ladder, we forget the importance of play. And, you know, I'll just tell a quick story. I had the opportunity to be part of this summer camp for adults, right? It's called Camp Grounded. It's a tech-free summer camp for adults. It's a digital detox. So you're no technology, no phones, no computers, and no real names.
Does anybody make it through?
Oh, people love it. Oh, so it's so funny. They say, you know, when people get there, it's 4 days. We did it in the woods of Texas, upstate in New York and North Carolina, in the redwoods of California. When people get there, like, I'm not giving you my phone. I can't part ways with this thing. Like, I got to wait for a text message, or someone's about to text me, or I got a, you know, Instagram or something. And then 4 days later, they're like, I don't even want that thing back. Don't give it to me. They're like, I don't want it back. That's how powerful it is to spend a little bit of time off of it. But mm-hmm. but I share that because it's this opportunity, and this is people of all ages. This isn't just like teenagers or 20-somethings, campus people, 40s, 50s, 60s, even into their 70s coming to camp, and they have this opportunity to check in with their inner child. So you have to use a nickname. You can't use your real name. So if you have a nickname from summer camp or a nickname you love, you can use it. But then sometimes if not, we have nicknamers. So you can be Cookie Surprise or Popcorn or Chocolate Mousse or Bricky St. James or whatever it is. And the point is that you just get to be somebody else. You get to be this person that maybe you haven't channeled or thought of for many, many years. And I think, you know, anytime that I'm feeling stuck, anytime that I'm feeling unsure in my working life, or frankly, just in my life, I go back and I think about, like, what was that inner child of Adam, of Smiley back, you know, what would they do, right? What would they do? And it's like a nice thing. You kind of close your eyes. You can think about it. What would they do? Like, what outfit would have they put on, or who would they have been playing with in the playground or at school? Or what would they have said to their friend or to your family? It's a pretty powerful thing to do. And I think it kind of can be a nice way of reminding us what really matters in our life. So for me, you know, a little bit of that experience was kind of, I realized that I was at work trying to be someone that I wasn't. I was trying to kind of conform to this like fairly buttoned up kind of, you know, person to kind of rise up the corporate ladder. And that wasn't me. And I've actually achieved a lot more professional success now, written 3 books, and I speak all around the world, and I run my own business by being Smiley, by being myself, mm-hmm. by not trying to kind of go up somebody else's ladder, by building my own journey. And that has been really powerful, and everyone has to figure out what that specifically looks like. There's no right answers, and everyone is on their own journey. But for me, that was such a powerful discovery that, oh, I'm going to, first of all, I won't be able to write a book unless the book is truly me, unless it's in my voice, unless it's my stories and my experience. Like, I can't give a talk if I'm not talking about things that are true to me. I can't step on stage and act out somebody else. I have to be me. And I think I was living quite a bit of my young adult life trying to be somebody else, or trying to kind of fit into somebody else's box. So for me, the inner child is kind of coming back to yourself a little bit.
You know, I'm so glad you shared that. And to lean in a little bit on your story about being Smiley, one of my guests shared a story about his mom. He said that she had had a lot of domestic abuse in her life. And after one particularly harsh evening, he was out with her. They were in the community, and she was smiling. And he asked her, "Why are you smiling? I know what just happened last night." And she told him, and I paraphrase, that she was smiling to allow for all the angels, goods, and blessings that could come into her life, to welcome them in. She wasn't so focused on the turmoil of decisions and things that had occurred in her life as an adult as she was keeping that inner child hopeful, keeping it alive and allowing it to have a voice. And I just love the way you teach on this. Importantly, I love the way you live on this, Smiley. I mean, you've spoken before about your thoughts on multi-generational workforces and how we can bring smile to that. And now you've got me just finding smile in everything. But talk a little bit about your opinion on multi-generational workforces and how they work or can work.
Yeah, it's a great point. And I think, one thing I think is important to remember is that, you know, for the first time in history, there's five generations joining together every single day at work. So this is actually kind of unprecedented. It's never happened before. So all the way we have, you know, Gen Z, we have millennials, we have Gen X, we have baby boomers, and we have members of the silent generation, all kind of joining together every single day at work. That's a lot of different people with a lot of different histories, backgrounds, experiences, needs. So to create a kind of culture where everyone feels seen and heard is really important, right? So we have to make sure those young people, I mean, if you're a Gen Zer, you do not know a world without smartphones. Can you imagine that? So like, you don't know a world where the iPhone doesn't exist, where within two clicks or a swipe, I can get food delivered, an Uber, a car, a hotel, a date. If you're lucky, you can get a date with pressing one button. And then those people get to the workplace and they're like, wait, I can't just swipe right to get a promotion? Like, nope. Or I can't just swipe right and become the boss. Or change things up. Like, nope, it's going to take a little bit longer than swiping right. You can't, you know, or to find meaningful work or find purpose. Nope, it's not two clicks. But so they're expecting things to happen very quickly. And they're kind of sometimes surprised when they don't. So we have to make sure that those people feel right. That they feel seen and heard. Those are also people who, you know, Gen Z is the most diverse generation in history, right? 50% of Gen Z is a person of color. 50%, then those people enter the workforce and they don't see that diversity reflected among their fellow employees or their senior leadership or their board of directors, and they start asking questions, right? So those people, we have to make sure those people feel seen and heard, all the way up to people, many of whom are much older in the workplace, who often feel ignored as well for other reasons. Mm-hmm. They feel like, oh, they don't see me because I have gray hair or because I've been here for 25 years, right? They don't take my ideas.
Right.
Yeah, right. Because I don't. Yeah, exactly. Because I'm from a, you know, and so I think, you know, one thing I advocate is that we need to foster intergenerational co-leadership, where we're pairing early talent, right? Those young folks, those people that are really have great ideas, they're 20, 25, 26, 31, with folks that have a lot more experience. Right? Maybe they've been in the industry for 20, 25, 30 years. They've been with our company much longer. Pair those two people to co-lead projects that are very important to the company. So then what's going to happen is you're going to get the younger person sitting there being like, wait a second, I don't really know that much. I got a lot to learn. It's like, yeah, you do have a lot to learn. You're 26 years old. You don't know everything. And you're going to get that person who's much older saying, wait a second, this young person has a lot of really good ideas. They're thinking about the world in a whole different way. They represent the future of our company, of our firm. They represent the future of our clients, our customers. I better understand what's going on in their head. I better understand their ideas, how they see the world. Because if I don't, we're not going to have a business in 10 years. We're not going to have people to work here. Right. So you get those two people to co-lead a project and there's a lot more learning, a lot more synergy, a lot more growth. But both people have to come into it from a place of learning, of curiosity, of being open, not like it's my way, I'm right, you're wrong, or you're young, you don't know anything, or you're old, you don't know anything. It has to be both people seeing the value of everyone.
So what are the pushback, the objections that you hear most frequently when you're speaking with people in a position to affect the change? And by the way, we understand everyone's in a position to affect the change. Decision makers get to manage protocol. They get to manage how we measure for success in companies. What are some of the pushback points you get, and how do you speak to those? Because some of those people may be listening to you right now.
Yeah, I think there's the traditional pushback of that's not how we do things, right? Or we tried that, or, you know, this is the way things are, which I think is a really not helpful mindset, right? Kind of like, hey, you know, that's not us, or we already tried that, or, you know, this is just the way things are here, or, you know, and I think that that's really problematic, or kind of the pay your dues and wait your turn, right? Like, and a lot of times people will say, and I hear this a lot when it comes to the generational stuff, but, well, I had to go through it, so this person does too, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. So you think about many lawyers or doctors, like, well, I went through law school and I was an intern or I was an associate and we worked 80-hour weeks. So this person who's complaining about working, you know, late in the evening or on a Saturday morning, like, they should just, you know, say, hey, that's what you're supposed to do.
The books to find the case points, and you're going to sit there and type it and have it through AI in 2 minutes.
Right. Well, yeah, I mean, but totally. But then, you know, and then I'll say, okay, well, did you like working 80-hour weeks when you were a kid, you know, when you were younger? Did you like kind of having your boss, you know, yell at you all the time, or make you work on the weekend, or make you feel, you know, not safe? No. So why don't we change the behavior and try something new? So it's like, I think what people want to be, they want to be recognized for what they did, right? But that doesn't necessarily mean it's right. This is a story I like to tell. I remember this a woman, very senior partner at her firm, a law firm, very successful. She had an incredible career, and she, you know, we were talking about generations in the workplace, and she said, you know, these millennials, right? I'm a millennial. I'm an older millennial, elder millennial. And she said, these millennials, all they do is complain. They don't want to actually get work done, right? They don't actually want to work. They just complain. They're lazy. They don't want to get anything done. And I was like, okay, well, you know, why don't you, if you could give them one lesson, one learning from your career, what would it be? Right? You're complaining about them. What would that lesson be? And I said, think about it for a second. Don't tell me the first thing that comes to mind. Close your eyes. Think about it. Like, what would your lesson, your to millennials be? And she kind of closed her eyes. She thought about it. She was like, you know, I really wish if I could tell them one thing, it would be that, you know, I wish I hadn't missed so many moments with my family. And I said, wait a second. You were just complaining about these people not working hard enough. And you're saying that the one regret you have in your career is that you missed moments with your family, that you worked too hard. Mm-hmm. And she's like, yeah, well, that would be my lesson. That's my regret. And I said, huh, that's very interesting. And the point was, it's like, actually, she wanted so badly what these young people were asking for, but she hadn't had that opportunity. So that's where the conflict was. Like, I wish I was able to have more work-life balance. I wish I was able to have more flexibility. We didn't have that when I was in your position. There's a little bit of an element of jealousy there, or, you know, but that doesn't mean that we should make someone suffer like we did, or make someone have the same regret that we have. We should change it up. We should transform the culture. We should make things better. We should try new things. Just because it didn't work before, let's not kind of say, oh, well, that's how it's been. We got to make everyone go through this. Like, no, that doesn't make any sense. That's not how change happens. Change happens because some people are like, you know what? This didn't work for us. This didn't work for me. Or this wasn't working for everyone. Or this wasn't inclusive. Or whatever it is, let's try something different. And that's really critical.
And, you know, likely Smiley, she was lonely, even with so much family that she had. She's expressing missing the time with them. She may also be expressing missing time and gift to herself. So that's really wild. There's a lot in that story. And I think many of us know elements of that story that we can create positive change from. Before we go 4 for 4, speak to some specific practices or habits that individuals can cultivate to maintain strong social connections and combat loneliness.
Yeah, that's a great one. So for me, this is kind of like, you know, one of my favorites is to start small. I think that, you know, we have this sense when we kind of talk about something like belonging or connection, that we gotta, all right, I gotta change my whole life up. I gotta start using new apps and tools, and I gotta get a CRM, and it's all, you know, whatever. One a day, one connection a day, you know, and that can be, you know, just going deeper with one colleague at work, asking a better question, getting to know someone that you haven't connected with at work, kind of just that one little element, or you know, it could be in your neighborhood, in your community, at your church, at a event that you're a part of, an association, institution, whatever it is, one connection a day that you just go a little bit deeper, and those add up, right? I don't think our role is to, you know, we talk so much about growth and scale and impact. I believe deeply in those things, right? That's how we make positive change in the world. But it happens by focusing on those micro interactions, making one new friend, or going deeper with a friend we already have, or getting to know someone that maybe a lot of people at work don't talk to, right? Just like, I'm going to get to know that person. Like, they don't, you know, I've kind of ignored them, or I haven't gotten to know who they are. Like, that's enough. If we do those things little by little, if everyone is doing those things, I think we do solve the loneliness epidemic. I think that's where it starts, in those very little micro interactions. So just to make it a little bit more attainable. And then just another one that I like to do is, you know, celebrate little things along the way. Celebrate the small wins. There's a lot of research that shows kind of the path to human flourishing. You have to savor, you have to celebrate the little wins on the way. We're so used to these, you know, at work, especially in a kind of corporate context, waiting for these huge milestones, right? You know, we hit these huge, you know, annual growth goals, or this is, you know, the revenue that we made, or whatever it is, all that matters, but you got to have little things along the way. We added a new client, or I published an article, or I saw a friend that I hadn't seen in a long time, or, you know, went to a family reunion. These little things along the way go so far. And I think we never take the moment to kind of just stop and be like, hey, this was really special. I'm going to celebrate this. I think that creates a lot more well-being, and is a really good path to, you know, creating more connection for ourselves and for other people as well.
That's beautiful. Why, in a world that's more populated than ever, how is it that we're more lonely than ever? And if it's going to get worse before it gets better, as you suggest, what's the promise?
The promise is that we have to do this. This is, you know, I like to say the future of work is human connection. If we don't do this, we won't have much of a world left. Or, you know, like, this is kind of an existential thing of, you know, there's not much point of living in a world without human connection. For me, at least, I don't know. I don't want to live inside of a headset. You know, I'm a human being. I want to live around other people. I want deep, meaningful relationships with other people at home and in my community, at work, in the world at large. We have to do this. This is, you know, as we go deeper and deeper into technology being part of how we live, how we work, these are incredible tools. I'm not saying they're not great tools. We have to build that human connection in lockstep with that, right? And the technology is expanding at such a rapid rate. If you think about just social media, how much has happened in the last 5, 10, 15 years, and now AI, how much is changing every week, every day, how fast this stuff is growing. We have to consciously, intentionally create more human connection for ourselves, or we're going to be left behind, and it's going to be a pretty miserable, you know, life. So I think that this is kind of an existential thing of, if we want to find meaning and joy and purpose and happiness in our lives, it's all about other people. And the research shows that there's studies that have been shown that, you know, the people that are the happiest at the age of 80 have the best social relationships at the age of 50. Like, that's Harvard has done this study, like the longest longitudinal study on adult happiness. And that's what they found. It's, you know, wealth matters, yes. And what really determines people's success and their happiness in life is social relationships. The quality of who's in your life, right? Who's going to come hang out with you when you're sick? Mm-hmm. Who can you call when you have a question, when you need it, when you need an extra hand, when you need someone to talk to, when work's not going so well, or life, you know, you hit a rut. Like, it's about the people in your life. That's what matters most.
Love, 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 love that. That's a perfect place to transition. Are you ready to go 4 for 4?
Yes, let's do it.
Okay, so I'm going to ask you 4 questions to which you'll give me 4 answers, no wrong nor right answers. And the first question is, you get to host a dinner, Smiley, and invite anyone you want from past to present, so long as they're human. Who's at your table and why?
Okay, so I thought about this actually in duos. So like I would love to kind of have people that are already kind of friends. And because I would like to learn about their stories a little bit. Yes. So I have two pairs of duos. Well, I actually have 4 pairs of duos. So Barack Obama and Michelle Obama would be one pair. I had worked on the Obama campaign back in 2008. So I just kind of, I've always been a fan of what's that?
You're going to give him a dinner.
Yeah, exactly. So, I just kind of am fascinated by their story and just kind of want to hear kind of what their life has been like, kind of, you know, in their full whole spectrum of their life. So I think that would be really fun. Larry David and Jerry Seinfeld. Seinfeld's my favorite TV show. So I love comedy and I love that show's meant a lot to me. So I'd love to kind of hear their stories. So those would be kind of my 4.
Oh, I love it so much. And you know what? They're going to enjoy each other along with you. That's fantastic. So we're going 2 for 4. What music, what 4 pieces of music have you been listening to? By artist or song and wine?
Yeah. So Kelly McFarling is one. She's an incredible singer-songwriter. She lives here in the Bay Area. She's really wonderful, and been listening a lot to her. Rainbow Girls, who are another band. Tracy Chapman, I've been listening to a lot recently because she just did a performance at the Grammys, which was incredible. And I listened to her a lot when I was a kid. My parents really loved her.
I was going to ask you if you were going OG with her.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then Andre 3000's new album, New Blue Sun, which is him playing the flute, which is really beautiful. And I was always a big Outkast fan and love that he's exploring new genres.
I actually haven't listened, so I'll go listen.
Oh, it's incredible. Yeah. Yes. Yes. It's him playing the flute. It's incredible.
Thank you. Thank you for that turn up for me. Let's go 3 for 4. What 4 books do you recommend our family read and why?
Well, the first is The Other Significant Others by Raina Cohen. This book just came out. It's all about the importance of putting friendship at the center of your life. Mm-hmm. So not just our significant others, like our partners, but also our friends. It's really beautiful. I just started reading it, just came out. So it's a great book. Another is 4,000 Weeks by Oliver Berkman, which is all about just thinking about the meaning of life and our time. Another is Together by Dr. Vivek Murthy, which is about the loneliness epidemic. And the 4th is Man's Search for Meaning by Viktor Frankl.
Fantastic. Thank you. Wonderful, my friend. So I'm looking forward to the other 3. And then now we're going 4 for 4. What 4 pieces of advice do you offer to our family and why? And listen to this, Smiley, if it was advice given to you by someone else, please show homage to the author of you.
4 pieces of advice. One that was really taught to me by my friend who had started that summer camp for adults that I mentioned, Camp Grounded, which is, you don't need to change the lives of millions of people. You just need to change the lives of 1 or 2 other people. Mm-hmm. Another would be wherever you are, start wherever you are.
So whether that's if you're trying to become an author, start with an article, start with kind of writing down some ideas. The book's not going to happen right away. The third, it would be, if you feel, like your work isn't meaningful, try something new. doesn't have to happen right away. I'm not saying like tomorrow. But like, I think we deserve to spend our lives doing something that's meaningful and purpose driven, especially if we have the opportunity to do that. And lastly, it would be, to put friendship at the center of your life and to really think, what is it like to live a life where you prioritize, people in it, and especially your friends?
Oh my goodness, that centers so much of what we talked about. It centers so much about what we are living about, doesn't it?
It really does. Thank you so much for this wonderful conversation. It was such a joy to talk to you.
Thank you from my heart to your home. Thank you, thank you, thank you.